Off the ball
on News Talk.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
You're very welcome back. We're live here with Bernard Jackman. If you want to podcast the pay-per-view with Gary O'Toole and Brendan O'Brien from the Irish Examiner, you can do that. Go to offtheball.com/podcasts, or equally you'll get us on iTunes or Audio Boom or wherever you tend to get your podcasts. So that is there for you. If not right now, it certainly will be in the next while. Bernard Jackman, you're very welcome to studio. Hello.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
Dragons coach, your Twitter bio says, life is like a taxi ride. The meter keeps on ticking, whether you're getting anywhere or just standing still. That was a very profound one.
That's an old one, yeah.
Bernard Jackman, a man conscious of the passage of time and how precious all these years are?
Yeah, I think it's important to make sure you're making an impact. I certainly want to be able to look back when I've finished coaching without any regrets and feel that I've changed any organisation I've been in. So, that's pretty much why I do what I do.
Mm. It struck me it must be one. I mean, we all have those thoughts. The years are precious for all of us, and time is going by very quickly, whether you're doing something with your life or not. But especially for sports people who in their 30s get hit with that equation squarely between the eyes, this is how quickly time goes.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate. This is my 21st year making a living out of sport.
Right.
I had 1 year in between where I lost my contract and I was working as a medical rep. But
what age were you then?
I was 24. Yeah, so I had a real kick in the butt. Didn't have a contract. Kind of went back to UBL, All-Ireland League with Clontarf for a year. Got a job with AstraZeneca, calling around to doctors in the Leinster region. But I knew I only had a year to get back in, so thankfully it went well. I had a big season with Clontarf, and I ended up having an offer from Leinster and Connacht at the end of that season. And sitting down with Eddie O'Sullivan, and he said, listen, I think you should go back to Connacht to get more game time to try and get capped.
And as a 24-year-old, as you're driving around from doctor to hospital to doctor, is part of you thinking, I could deal with this, I could live with this? Or was it a realisation that, oh my God, the real world compared to rugby is awful?
I could have done both. I could have definitely done the real world. I just would have had to change my mindset, but I was still ambitious. I travelled to South Africa with Ireland as a 19-year-old, as a kind of a young up and coming player, so I kind of got a feeling for it, and I realised I missed it. I realised I had potentially the talent to make it, or to definitely get back into the pro game, but I just needed to probably knuckle down and be a lot harder on myself.
Yeah. The other interesting thing I saw about that time is that you had studied business and Japanese.
Yeah, that was previous to that. So when I left, I wasn't very good. I played SCT for Newbridge, but I wasn't in any of the talent ID squads. I didn't play the Ireland schools or any of that.
Right.
For me, my goal was to just play AIL. I thought if I could play AIL, that'd be unbelievable.
Okay.
But I went to DCU to study international marketing and Japanese. I did that for 2 years, and I was just about, I'd spent a year in Lansdowne, then I joined Clontarf. Brent Pope recruited me to Clontarf, who was closer to DCU, and at the end of that year rugby went pro, and Warren Gatland, actually, which has kind of led me to why I'm in the Dragons, Warren Gatland got a Connacht job.
Yeah.
He came on, so Warren Gatland took a sabbatical from teaching in New Zealand to take on Galwegians. We played Galwegians in, it was Division 2 of the AIL. He was player coach, but he didn't really want to play, but he ended up putting himself on the bench, hooker, came on against me for the last 20 minutes because of an injury. 2.5 months later, he gets a call to become the Connacht coach. There was a dispute with Eddie O'Sullivan, and Warren came in at the last minute.
Yeah.
And he was short of hooker, and he remembered me from that game, rang me up, and I said, oh, I'm going to Japan in September, because for your third year of your degree, you had to spend 6 months in college in Japan, 6 months in work. And he was, listen, no one knows if rugby's going to take off, because I don't know if you remember, but the RFU weren't 100% sure they wanted to go down the professional route. It was very early days. And he said, there was actually only five full-time contracts in each province, and then there was some part-time contracts. And he said that if you go to Japan, whoever gets your contract will be a year ahead.
Mm.
And no one knows if, so when you come back, you're going to be behind. And he said also, no one knows if rugby's only going to be professional in Ireland for a year. So you could have been one of 20 players ever to be professional. But in fairness, because he was a teacher, he was into education, so he advised me to change course, and I got a business studies degree from DCU in the end, and I commuted up and down. And,
right.
But yeah, thankfully, he gave me some good advice.
Wow, that is sliding doors stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, just lucky.
What did you do in those 15 minutes against Gatland?
I don't know.
Gouged him?
No, I didn't. I don't know what. I don't know. Obviously, he didn't really have many options. And I think Brent Pope, in fairness, put in a really good reference for me. Yeah, and obviously they knew each other from New Zealand. So just sometimes you can get, you need those breaks along the way, and I certainly got a lot of them.
And what an amazingly small world now that you're coaching the Dragons, and Warren Gatland is
And in fairness, he helped me. Like he, so the background to that is the Dragons have been financially struggling for 6-7 years. So when rugby went pro first, there was a bit of money in Newport. A fellow called Martin Hazel became the chairman investor, and they signed Percy Montgomery, Gary Tyseman, Shane Howard, etc. And they had a bit of success, you know, Friday Night Lights in Newport, beating the biggest teams in Europe. And then it became regional, and effectively it would be like trying to join Young Munster, Gary Owen, Shannon together and creating a franchise. Effectively, the Valleys teams, which are part of our region, hated the City Slickers, or, and vice versa, and it just became really, really hard. And because Newport was in the name, it ostracised all the those other clubs, because Gwent is a proud rugby region. You know, Gwent beat the All Blacks, you know, back in the 60s. There's a huge amount of there's more senior clubs in Gwent than there is in any of the other regions. So, but unfortunately, the region was divided. And even a small thing like that name, and the fact, of course, that the chairman was the guy who was synonymous with Newport, stopped the region united. So the club then 4 or 5 years ago, they decided they're not going to put any more money into it. So basically they kept cutting costs. So our playing salary dropped to the under the minimum limit. Things like medical, travel, etc. was cut to the bone. So we didn't keep any of our best players, like Toby Falto, Luke Charters, etc. left the Dragons. And success didn't happen on the field, which obviously decreases revenue. So the WRU bought it in May, and Warren obviously recommended me to the WRU, and I sat down with Warren before the Lions, or I spoke to him on the phone a couple times before the Lions tour, and he said, listen, there's good talent here, we just need someone to go in and clean it up. So unfortunately that's what I'm doing.
That's you, because I mean the Dragons for a long time have been struggling. So the lowest Welsh finisher for 6 of the last 7 years, just kind of considered the forgotten child in some respects of Welsh rugby. And I was reading last night about the Newport-Gwent rivalry, and it really does run deep between the region and the City Slickers, Newport, and it just never felt right to a lot of people to be mushed together.
No.
Like, interestingly, that you've dropped the Newport-Gwent out of the name. You're trying to want just the Dragons to be a kind of a clean step away from all that. Is that the thinking?
Yeah, it is the thinking, but it is a clean state. I mean, this is completely different. There hasn't been a real plan about what they're going to do with the region, and we have a lot of talented youngsters. So effectively my job, the problem has been that there's a lot of talent in the region, right, but they haven't been playing. So we had quite a few journeymen playing, and we weren't getting results anyway. It didn't make any sense. So I came in and I looked at the squad, and I saw some really good youngsters who had no experience, and I think that was the feeling that was mirrored at national level. There was Dragons players on the national succession plan, probably further down, 5th, 6th, 7th choice, but not getting any Pro 14 action. So we said, listen, this year let's give those youngsters an opportunity. Let's create a really good environment around them where you know they're getting the best medical care, they're getting the best S&C, they're getting the best rugby coaching, and let's then see what we need to recruit to basically make the region successful. Part of that was to try and find a chairman. So the WRU bind the region.
And just for people, because we're all fairly insular in a lot of ways, so back in May it had seemed like the owners of the Newport Gwent Dragons, the Dragons, were saying, look, we're kind of done here and we're wrapping this up. And at that point the Welsh Rugby Union owned 50% of the Dragons, and so they bought the other 50% from the owners, so now it's run by the Welsh Rugby Union.
Yeah, but it had to be passed by the members of the old Newport Rugby Club, and there was a big worry about, because I was actually involved. I was speaking to the WRU while this vote was about to go on, and at one stage it looked like the vote was going to be a no to take over to Welsh WRU takeover, which would have effectively bankrupt the club, meant there was no regional rugby in that region, and it just became Newport who still play in the Premiership, and they get 2,500 to 3,000 people to home games. So, but at one stage it looked like it could be a no, and it would have been down to 3 regions.
Right.
Thankfully, the WRU were able to convince the members that it was the right thing to do, and that's given a security in terms of players. You know they're going to get paid.
Yeah.
It's given a security in terms of being able to add some additional staff, but it's not going to give us money to go out and recruit players and drive the market up in Wales. I mean, the WRU, you have to be very careful of that. So effectively what we need to do is find a chairman who was willing to come in and steer the business part of it. And we have a guy called David Buttress who set up Just Eat, the takeaway app, a local man who's done well commercially, massively passionate about rugby and wants to actually be part of this story. So now I think we've got a perfect storm. I think we've got clarity in terms of how we want to play. We've got a good staff. We've got the security of having everything underwritten by the WRU, but we also have the dynamism of a new chairman who's put together a really talented board to help drive it commercially.
Yeah, so it's potentially, as you said, perfect storm, really good time for you to go in there. And yeah, I saw you've been able to put in your own staff, which you feel is 100% crucial.
Exactly, because of cutbacks, the Dragons were understaffed. They only had a head coach, a backs coach and a forwards coach. And in most modern organisations, that doesn't allow you to give the detail you need to your players. So I was able to bring in a skills coach. And first, that was all part of the negotiations. Would I have money for staff?
So you were conscious of not just jumping at this when you got the call from Gatland or from the Welsh Union?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it was no one would touch the Dragon. If you looked at them on the pitch last year or the last few years, and we all have, and I did from afar because obviously I watched a lot of what was Pro 12, you knew there was something wrong with us. But I only found out when I started to do a bit of research why it was so badly broken. But also you needed to make sure that the people who were buying it understood that, and understood that there was going to have to be investment to turn it around. And they'd all do, and they wanted to turn around. I mean, I couldn't speak highly enough of them in terms of how we spoke about the project before it started, and everything that's happened since, they've been really supportive. Right. And they know that it's going to take a while, but once they're informed about the plan, they just let me crack on, which is great.
Yeah. So when the phone call comes, where are you in your coaching life? The phone call comes to
I'm out of work.
Are you close to desperate to get back into work? You enjoying being out of work?
No, sorry.
How long had you been out of work?
8 weeks.
Okay. That's a holiday in my book.
But I was starting to guess. It was great. I spent a lot of time at home. Yeah. Brought the kids to school, all that stuff.
Are you worried?
No, I had. Thankfully, I had contact with a couple of clubs.
Okay.
I just didn't know where we were going to be, and that.
So you had choices.
Yes, thankfully, I'm really fortunate that. So I had a choice to stay in France. Choices to. A bit of chat to go down to South Africa for a while to do some consultancy in the Bulls. There was obviously the Japanese connection.
Can you speak Japanese?
I can't. So I finished Japanese I dropped out of the course in 2000. Got my first cap in Japan in 2005. So I was there for 2 weeks. Of course, I was made liaison officer by the players. So I was the one sent around to ask direction. So obviously, my Japanese wasn't great in 2005, but it started to come back over the course of the second week.
And does the Tolo accent lend itself to Japanese?
More so than it does to French.
Than
it does to French, yeah. my kids ripped me apart for my French.
How's the French?
No, I'm fluent, but...
It sounds woeful.
Yeah, it sounds woeful, yeah. They're fluent, but they speak it like a French person would.
Yeah.
I'll never get
and
to
you
that.
Speak it like a Tolo person.
I speak it like a Paddy. A Tolo person, exactly. So, in fairness, the players got used to it. I have no problem. Like, I did everything through French over there, and that was good. I like languages.
You had options.
The thing about the Japanese was that they loved the fact that I'd already gone through the process of coaching in a second language.
Okay.
Which for a lot of the New Zealanders and Australians takes them a year to deal with that frustration. It is a totally different animal. Mm. And also the fact that I studied Japanese, they felt that I would pick it up quickly, retouch on it. So, but in fairness, while I knew I would be in work, it has to be the right fit for family, and has to be the right move to hopefully progress my career. Mm. So I'm not saying it wasn't stressful. It was, but thankfully there was a few options.
It's a different kind of stress to will I ever work again?
Yeah.
My phone isn't ringing. When does 8 weeks become 16 weeks?
Yeah.
When am I out of work a year or two? And
yeah, I think in this game, if you take a year out, unless you've got a really powerful CV, it's pretty hard to get back in.
Is that because the game is evolving hugely at the moment in particular, or has that always been the case?
I think it's always been the case, yeah. Right. I just think, people move on. There's someone else has done something great. There's a retiring player who looks like he's potential. Yeah. And while I have a decent network, and I think that's important, I would have thought a year out would have been very risky.
Did you move the whole family over to Wales?
No, I didn't. one of the options we had would have meant that I could live anywhere in the world for a year while I was working, kind of consulting. I would have been working building something new. With a lead to going into coaching the year after. And we said, well, if we live anywhere in the world, let's live in Dublin. Because we've been in France for 5 years, which was brilliant. But we want our kids to be Irish. Yeah. You know, they're picking up a lot of French mannerisms and ways, which is great. But we want them to be Irish. My wife and I both are very proud of being Irish. We enjoyed our childhoods in Ireland.
What are French mannerisms that children pick up?
Just body language and just...
Very French
and apathy, and you know, towards things, and a lot of no word answers, just noises. And
I think you'll find out that's just children.
Well, we'll see.
I don't think they're going to come home and be like, "Dad, I'm so happy to see you now." Dad, do come into my room. Let's talk. Yeah,
I don't want to have an espresso and a cigarette for breakfast. You know? France is brilliant, but we've been away from both sets of grandparents are still in great health.
Right.
And, you know, they're over a lot, but just be back in Ireland, I think, is good. We want to learn Irish as well, and we just want them to get some roots. I think it's easy for us as rugby coaches to be really nomadic and just pack up and move on to a new project, but for family wise, it's important to try and have some stability. So when I veered towards the Dragons option, we looked at it and we felt that it was still the right thing to do for the family to live in Dublin for a year at least, and to see how the commute goes. So effectively, there's 8 flights a day between... So Newport's kind of halfway between Cardiff and Bristol. So there's 8 flights a day between Bristol or Cardiff to get to Dublin.
Okay.
I come home on a Tuesday night usually because Wednesday's our day off. So Wednesday's like a normal person's Sunday. And then I go back on a Thursday morning on a really early flight. I'm in work at a 8:15. And then if we play Friday night, I'll come home Saturday, which we did. We played the Blues on Friday night. I came home Saturday morning. Go back. I'm on the way back now. And if we play on a Saturday, they'll come over for the weekend. So it's not ideal.
How are you finding it? That does strike me as tough, I must say.
Yeah, well, the only thing is, so a lot of our work is analysis and laptop. So when you're travelling, you know, you can crack on a short flight. So I try and obviously on a Wednesday, I try and not do too much, get the work done on the way over and way back. And then unfortunately weekends is you have to go into work, you have to be ready to go into work tomorrow and be ready to review. So it's not ideal, but when we get a school holidays, they'll come over to us. And listen, I think it's the best case scenario for us as a family and allowing me kind of try and get stuck into the work over there, because there's a huge amount of work to do.
I'm sure there is. And what is the hope for the Dragons come the end of this season? Because I saw you say a very interesting point you made, and you were talking in a general sense here, and I appreciate the Dragons as well are maybe starting from a lower base, but you said generally in coaching it takes a year and a half to build an attacking system and it takes a year to build a defensive system. So you're in that first year and a half of sorting all this stuff out. So what's realistic?
I think we're making good progress in our attack. So last year our attack was horrible. We were averaging 1.7 tries per game. We've only played 6, but we're up to 2.4. Last year we got 1 attacking bonus point, or we've already got 2. I think that defensively, my defence coach was really good, but he arrived late because there was visa issues. He's South African. So effectively, we front-loaded the attack. So during pre-season, we spent more time attacking than defending, because I didn't want to start something. I wanted him to have a clean slate, and he's making good strides there. The issue we have is that we don't have enough depth. So against Ulster 2 weeks ago, you know, I made 16 changes, and we shipped 50 points. Now, six of that group played their first ever pro game. So there's...
Wow.
Which is a lot, you know what I mean, to send to Ravenhill.
6 together in one game to Ravenhill.
Yeah.
Best of luck.
Exactly. We knew what we had to do. So the situation I have is very different. If I was coaching the Ospreys, the Scarlets or Blues, who were, you know, 4 or 3 other Welsh teams, and make a comparison with them rather than the Irish model, you wouldn't have to do that. You're over the course of the last 4 or 5 years, they've either drip-fed their youngsters game time. So they're at a level now where when they come into the team, the standard doesn't noticeably drop. And also they've probably kept a hold or recruited better athletes, or developed them better. Okay, so, you know, I don't feel that the Dragons have done a good enough job developing our players athletically. And our new head of medical is, you know, he's coming from Warrington Wolves. He's head of performance in the Warrington Wolves. He will give us some expertise in that. The Welsh Union had the same feeling. So the their head of S&C, who was the S&C for the Lions, he's in quite regularly. He's oversees all our programs. And also, the week that we sent, you know, we made 16 changes up in Ulster, my first choice team, you know, did 8 gym sessions, 2 conditioning sessions, 4 skill sessions.
Okay.
So we need to find blocks in season. And the Challenge Cup this week is an opportunity to give some guys really individual care. The Irish provinces do it all the time for the internationals, but we don't. It's not noticeable because the depth is so good.
Yeah.
So effectively, what we have is, because we have the smallest budget in Pro 14 at the moment.
Even the Italian sides.
Yeah, we're lower than them. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, but next year we'll be above one of those.
So this is the Welsh Union will decide to allocate you more.
No, they'll only give us what they've given us. What. They won't give us anything extra.
Okay, so this will be private funds brought in.
Exactly.
Okay.
So the chairman now has put the board together.
Okay.
And the Dragons, obviously, because on-field hasn't been successful, commercially it's been more difficult.
Yeah.
But he also feels that commercially we're not maximising our potential. So effectively, I'll have more money to recruit. So we'll have better depth next year. But also our job this year is to develop the players athletically, so they're more robust. So we've 27 injuries at the moment, and that obviously hurts. So against Cardiff Blues, we were up at half time. On the 55th minute mark, they brought 6 internationals off the bench. I had 4 academy players on the bench, and we lost the game.
Yeah, okay. Interestingly, actually, Di Young today of Wasps in the I think it's Sunday Independent is making the point that they're struck down by injuries. The whole Premiership seems to have more injuries than it usually might 5 or 6 games in. He was making the point that with the new laws they're working to, there's 6 new laws, a lot of them are in the breakdown. He was saying effectively, actually you're quoted in the piece, but he was saying we're noticing 50 more tackles, more collisions per game.
Yeah,
is that right? Is that
on the ground as coaches, we feel, well, certainly the coaches I've spoken to and some of the things I've read, we feel that the game is more attritional this season than it was last season. But I noticed Andy McGeady did a big study of the stats, and he feels the stats show it's not. That's not the case. And he put a huge amount of research into it. But certainly I would feel that the collisions are bigger. Maybe not. I felt there was. Our stats showed us more. Okay, but his stats over the Pro 14 and the Aviva Premiership show it's pretty similar.
Right.
Our stats show us more. Certainly, the way the laws have changed around the breakdown, it's a ruck much quicker than it was. Just 2 players. Also, the tackler has to get out and go around. Certainly, the referees are favouring the attacking side. So there's not as much risk or there's not as much reward to send bodies into the defensive breakdown. The only way you can slow the ball down is 2 men hits, and then both those get back in the defensive line. So effectively, teams generally have 14 under feet, no space, bigger collisions. So potentially, Di Young is wrong, our stats are wrong, because it's so early doors, 6 games isn't enough to...
It's too small a sample size.
But we certainly feel that the players are getting the collisions are having a bigger impact on players.
Wow. Okay.
And also, at first, I have to say, for the Dragons, some of those injuries are down to the change in intensity how we train. So effectively, I'm not happy with the intensity we've trained at.
So you're up in that.
I'm up in that, and I know there's going to be people breaking down.
Yeah.
But we just need to get through that, because if I don't do that for my good guys, for my starting team, if they get the opportunity to play international rugby, they're going to be found wanting.
Yeah.
And also for us as a region, it's just something that has to become part of our DNA. So the short term pain with that, in terms of guys breaking down, we just need to make sure we rehab them well, and when they come back from that rehab, that their load has been high enough, their intensity of their rehab means that they're not vulnerable to breaking down again.
Very interesting. So, I mean, you need to be really confident in what you're doing to justify that.
Yeah.
Because you're not deliberately, but you're consciously training in a way which could lead to guys breaking down. You really need to be able to say to everyone, this is why we're doing it. Trust me, I'm experienced. Yeah. I know what I'm doing. Where do you feel you are now on the coaching spectrum of beginner to greatness? What are you good at?
I think I'm good at organizing a program. I think I'm good at making a short-term, medium-term, long-term plan. I think I'm good at convincing people within our organization, players, other staff, shareholders, the board, that this is the plan we need. So making an assessment of where we're at and explaining that, I think it's really important. So if I wasn't able to sell that plan to the board, and I send make 16 changes to go to Ulster, shift 55 points, well then there's going to be question marks about why are we doing that, and that could affect your short term, your next short term decision, which could affect the medium term plan. So I think I'm getting better at that.
Right.
I think I'm becoming way more less technical. I think all I need to do now is to hire people who are very focused on the minutiae day to day. And I suppose for me, it's about actually creating a better organization and a better program.
Maybe be more of a delegator.
Yeah. I just changed. So obviously when I went to France first, I was defense coach, breakdown coach, collision coach, and you can just crack on to actually making players better in those little areas where I suppose now my overall responsibility is our game plan, how we want to play, how we play each week. But then it's a bigger picture. Well, you know, what's our depth chart look like? You know, what's our squad going to look like next year? So we're going to go from 44 senior players to 40. To do that, obviously that's going to free up some money to invest in better quality, but also we need to make sure that our players are more robust. So you're managing your S&C, your medical, you're dealing with agents, all that stuff. It's really enjoyable.
Yeah. What are you bad at?
Probably not getting, just stepping away and letting, I suppose, trusting each coach to look after their area. You know, I think I'd get better at that. In France, that was a big issue. I think now the difference of France and here is that apart from Mike Prendergast and Aaron Dundon, Mike I had for 2 years and Aaron Dundon I only had for a year, I didn't hire any of the staff, so I inherited them, and that was probably part of an issue. Whereas now I've brought in two of the staff, and I think the other staff I've inherited work really hard and they actually are really good. So I think I'm probably getting probably more trust in those and just letting them crack on.
Was the year you had in charge as head coach at Grenoble, was that just end-to-end stressful, difficult, a really difficult, steep learning curve? Or
it was amazing in terms of learning.
But
I wouldn't want to go through it again. I think that's probably one of the, you know, one of the selling points for working for a union-owned side. In fact, that's what I've known in Ireland. You know, in Ireland, if you play for any of the provinces, apart from one period in Connacht's history, you know, when you come in on a Monday morning and you put your gear bag in the locker, all you think about is just getting better. You don't worry about are you going to get paid at the end of the month. You know, is the province going to be alive? In France, so I got the job in April, and shortly after that, our sugar daddy passed away, and I had a meeting with the board, and they said, "Oh, it's not going to affect us financially. Don't worry." But then in September, I got called to a crisis board meeting and said, "We need to ask the players to take a pay cut tomorrow." And it just became crisis after crisis. Then, and those financial decisions didn't affected your ability to sign a medical joker if you had an injury. We weren't able to travel your selection, because in France, a lot of the TV money is based on hitting a certain number of French qualified players at the end of the year, an average. So we were in a relegation battle, which we were for the previous 5 years. The 5 years I was there was always about staying up. But then suddenly you weren't actually able to pick the team you wanted. Every week you had to have a certain amount of French players in there. So those things, in fairness, and managing and handling that communication was a real learning curve. But it also made me so certain that to work in this job, to work at your best, you need to have confidence in the people you work for.
Yeah. I saw a quote from you. One of the big learning things you said was align yourself with people of the same ambition.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I was ambitious. The club said they were ambitious. And then it became blatantly obvious. And I know that plans change. Obviously, the fact that the
main prime, source of revenue,
sponsor died, we had to all change our ambition. But then their ambition, it was doubtful whether their ambition was actually even to stay in the top 14 in the end. Because in France, you have to put 15% of your budget into an escrow account at the start of the year, to make sure that if the club goes bankrupt, there's money there to pay the players. And effectively, for certain clubs, if you stay up in the top 14, it's very hard to reduce your budget for the following year because people are tied into contracts. But if you get relegated, a lot of players have clauses that you can let them go.
Okay.
So the quickest way to
save money
is to get relegated, which allows you to access your escrow account.
Right.
Which means the following year, obviously in Pro D2, if your budget is 10 million instead of 20 million, 15% of that is much less, you have instant access to funds. So that kind of thing in France, and it's happened in loads of French clubs, a few French clubs who've been high profile have had financial issues. Toulon, you know, 15 years ago went bankrupt. Colombier were always a top side. Historically, they don't have the money anymore. You're a Pro D2 side. So it does happen in French rugby, and it's happened, I suppose, in London Welsh, in the Aviva Premiership. But I think the Dragons now have that security. We don't have any more money than... We still won't, even with a new investor, we won't have any more money than anybody else. But I think we have enough money, we just need to use it well.
Well, there's stability, and you've got your own team, and everybody wants to do as well as possible.
Exactly.
Being relegated mightn't result in potential financial rewards. Like, there was an interest, I'm curious to know about the players at Grenoble, because Gavin Mortimer, the journalist, was tweeting around the time of your departure, and L'Equipe, or he was talking about, there was a piece in L'Equipe about some of your detractors in the dressing room.
Yeah.
And allegedly, according to L'Equipe, some of your detractors reproached you for physical training that was too hard and an offensive system that was too complicated, which I would think would be a good thing. So your offensive system was too complicated for them. Their training was too hard. And then Gavin tweeted, he's an English-speaking journalist based over there. I've just spoken to someone at Grenoble to find out more about life under Bernard Jackman. Apparently one of his, quote, brutal measures was to ban desserts at mealtimes. This, says my source, caused a war in the dressing room.
So I think the problem was that...
Did you ban dessert?
I tried to limit our desserts to one a day instead of two.
Did this cause a war?
It didn't cause a war, but it was just another... It was... And in fairness, it's a really difficult one, because a part of the, I suppose, the key to surviving in France... A lot of foreign coaches fail in France, because even Jake White ran into difficulties in Montpellier because he ostracised some of the French players. And it's a really fine balance between buying into what makes them special and also trying to, I suppose, not go away from your core philosophy. So effectively, we came back, the lads came back from 6 weeks off, which was I felt was too long anyway, but the president said, no, they need 6 weeks off. A lot of them came back outside the barometers we'd set for body fat.
What is a rugby player these days? I know it depends on position.
Well, position, I think some of the backs are, you know, 8-9%, right. Single figures. And even some of the heavy boys wouldn't be more than, you know, 12%.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, it's transformed. The players in general, particularly in the top clubs in France and the top clubs in the rest of Europe, are very good at actually managing their off seasons. So they come back, they train during their off seasons, they look after their diet, and they come back in good nick, and you can kick on. Whereas, unfortunately, we had some players who kind of came from Pro D2 with a club, or we recruited from Pro D2, and for them, looking after themselves wasn't really part of their makeup. So they came back unfit, on overweight, and they felt that we'll catch up. You know what I mean? So we brought in measures, you know, early morning sessions for Fat Club. It's not new. It's in every professional club has punishments for people who don't look after themselves, and that became a bugbear. The players went to the president and said, "Oh, this is crazy. You know, we shouldn't be up at 6:30 in the morning to train." Blah blah. And it wasn't a massive issue. It was just one of
many
issues about trying to make them more professional, trying to get them to do video analysts, trying to get them to turn up on time for their physio appointments. Unless you've been in France, it's hard to understand how lackadaisical they can be about certain parts of the preparation. And it's worse in the smaller clubs who are just fighting for promotion or to stay up, because for them it's about picking 10 or 11 games a year and getting unbelievably revved up for those and staying up. And once they do that, it's just like they're kings. Yeah. And, you know, because the board had said to me they wanted to change, get away from that mentality. But as soon as we started to make those changes that you need to do, they didn't really understand it. And that caused some friction.
Friction, because you come from a culture where the game plan has become sacrosanct now.
Yeah.
And the notion of even any interview with any rugby player or coach in this part of the world where they don't talk about sticking to the process and knowing my role and all these phrases now which have become commonplace, it's still genuinely, and because it's kind of surprising, but genuinely seems to be the case in France that the game plan is very, 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 very far from sacrosanct.
Yeah.
It's about feeling good on the day. Let's go for this pre-match talk is kind of doing a lot of the work. It's quite old school.
It's all about emotion. First, we'd actually started that attacking process 3 years before that, changing and putting more detail on our attacking game plan.
Grenoble,
and we always were top. Our attack became a top six attack.
Right.
Other areas of it, set piece and defence, let us down. But
so when did it become too complicated?
When training was too hard. When some people weren't going to be recontracted. People were being pulled up about body fat, and also when people were being held to task about not doing their job within that attacking system. So effectively what the French players don't want, like, is, this is very generic, just really good French players, but the players I had, and a lot of because I did my coaching badges in France, so I kind of we spent I spent 10 weeks with 24 other coaches, so I kind of got a good feel for what they see as being important, and they didn't like actually being accountable. So, you know, that's the fifth rook you're supposed to clean on the outside there, for example. Where were you? You know, and yeah, they said, I thought I could go blindside or whatever. And that, within every system, there has to be opportunities for people to play what they see. But when that's based around actually just not knowing your role or not working hard enough to get there,
yeah,
they have to be challenged on. And then it became an issue, you know. So, but in fairness, so during my coaching course, we had one of our modules was around game plan. And it became pretty obvious after the first day that the majority of the room actually didn't really want to give players any game plan.
Right.
And, you know, I challenged that, and the feeling was, if you wrote anything down or you nailed your colours to the mast on a certain way of playing against X opposition,
yeah,
and that doesn't work, mm-hmm, that the players could potentially go to the president and basically say, well, Jackman said, you know, we got to do this. We did it. It didn't work.
Yeah.
So he's an average coach.
Yeah.
Whereas they felt it was better to kind of have quite a vague structure, and then, you know, if it doesn't work, well, then you can go and say the players aren't good enough.
Yeah.
You know what I mean, or the players didn't understand what I wanted. But yeah, so it's, now that's not like, there's some brilliant coaches in France, but,
and I presume some very technical coaches, yeah, who do have a game plan.
Really, really. So yeah, Galtier, Fabien Galtier, probably one of the most technical now. Yeah. So he potentially could be someone in line to be the French coach down the road. Obviously, he's got a strong squad.
I'm very interested to see what happens to the French national team,
yeah,
when they get a game plan.
Yeah, so Noves, the problem for Noves isn't that way.
Yeah.
So he's old school, creative vibe, pick a good team, you know, so be good at identifying talent
and let them express themselves.
Yes. So that hasn't cracked on, it hasn't worked yet. Yeah. I just don't see, unless you've got a massive advantage in terms of the athlete and the quality of player you can select from, that's not really going to work.
Yeah.
You know, I think France do have phenomenal players, but the problem now is defensive systems can shut down that individualism.
Yeah,
you know, over 80 minutes. So it's a tricky one now.
It's very interesting. No, it's very interesting, yeah, because even like Joe Schmidt now, we're at a point with Schmidt in Ireland now where the players genuinely seem to be fully confident that if they just do what Joe has told me to do, it's a good chance we're going to win.
Yeah.
And there's a reason they believe that, because quite often, if they've done what Joe's told them to do, they have won. And yeah, like that, I mean, that puts Joe kind of top of the tree, really. Yeah, that's why New Zealand are chasing him.
Yeah. Well, I don't think anyone struggle to find someone as technical or tactically good as Joe.
Right.
You know, in the world, I think he's done it. And players, if you give players a tool that makes the game easy for them or helps them win,
yeah,
of course they're going to play. Like, they're all competitive, you know. So
is the coaching fraternity such that you can call Joe Schmidt, whether you know him or not, and say, "Hi, Joe, Bernard Jackman here. Can I pick your brain?" Is that the dumb thing?
Generally, it is. To be honest, I think it's getting better at that. Yeah, I think that Joe is. I've never rang him, but I've met him a couple of times at games, and he's been incredibly open. I know he's helped out a lot of other coaches. Right. And
are there people that you call? Would you chat with Gatland? Would you chat with
first him? He's someone now. So Rob Howley or Rob McBride, who's the Welsh forwards coach, or Warren are pretty much up in our place once a week. I go meet them regularly, and that's great. I just think for me as well, like, so when in France you're flying solo a little bit, and obviously you can. I'm lucky enough to have a network of coaches and S&C people that I trust and I would hop ideas off.
Right.
But because we're making such a drastic change to the Dragons, I suppose having the ability to, I suppose, hop ideas and problem solve with people like Warren, you know, McBride, Howley, and then all their medical team, all their S&C team, and, you know, everything we do is measured, and obviously we look over that. So I suppose I've got instant feedback from them. You know, so we run a session, we say we want to get to this intensity, they come up and watch it. Obviously we have the GPS data, but also we have their eye.
Right.
You know, which I think we got to find. It's a fine balance between, you know, that natural understanding of from the eye point of view and also the science. You know, I'd hate to think that we just become completely science focused. As a coach, you also have to trust your instinct a little bit.
Do you find now with all the GPS and all the data, do you find it generally supports what you've seen with your eyes and your first hunch, your instinctive hunch from watching a training session or a game, is generally supported by the GPS? Or are there many occasions where you've watched a session that you thought was crap and then the GPS tells you, actually, that was okay?
No, I think now I've got enough experience. So I've been using it for whatever 7 years. Okay. So
generally it's in sync.
But what's really good for is live. So like, you know, we say we want to run 4K at a certain intensity, whatever, 96 meters per minute.
You say that before a game.
Yeah, we say that at training. Training.
Because a game, you don't know how a game's going to go.
No, we don't know how a game's going to go. But we would have certain KPIs. For example, when we get into the opposition 22, we want to see a big increase in our meters per minute. So because obviously it's harder there.
Yeah.
So we need to see an upgrade in our speed to feet, etc.
That's a big Joe Schmidt thing. I presume it's everything inside the 22. Everything goes up a big notch.
Exactly. Yeah. So in a game we can measure that. Okay. Sorry, in a game we would be able to say at halftime, we've had 5 entries into their 22 and we haven't, we did for half an hour. So, but what it does mean is during a training session, you know, you can say to them during a water break, okay, boys, that last block of 2.5 minutes was at X meters per minute. We're on track.
Okay.
Brilliant. Or you can say, listen, we're behind.
Yeah.
You know, and it just gives you, you would have a sense of yourself, but I think certain people like to have data.
Yeah.
You know, so there's people in my room who learn by writing, and there's people who learn by visual, and some people just really like those figures to be able to say, bang.
That's really interesting. I mean, it's amazing where the game is at right now and the skill and deciphering all this stuff. So then one other last thing. So you're at the Dragons. And I mean, it sounds really exciting, and you have the right level of control. You've come from, say, a Leinster environment where you saw Cheka establish a culture, and so now you're kind of the cultural architect, I suppose. What are the most important things when you're trying to set out on this journey now to get something at the Dragons which is akin to the culture that you had at Leinster? And I suppose I'm talking specifics. Is it stuff you put up on the wall? Is it stuff you're going to say? What is it?
Yeah, I think I think there was a cultural issue at Leinster when Cheka came in.
Yeah.
But the difference, he had unbelievable talent. So once he got the culture right, I mean, there was, you know, O'Driscoll, Sextons, etc.
Yeah.
It was going to be, you know...
it was going to work.
So at the moment...
And Jackman.
No, at the moment, I was a piano pusher. At the moment, it's about, I suppose, trying to do both at the same time. So trying to develop that talent we have, trying to recruit talent, and just get our environment right where people are honest to each other. You know, so at the moment, certainly it's getting better. So first few weeks of team meetings, you know, showing some clips of training, and effectively no one wanted to contribute. People are just hoping that they weren't picked out. Whereas I think in strong environments, the players are actually pulling each other up. And saying, listen, that's not good enough, or that's great. You know, giving positive feedback as well, because
it's not about your effing crap.
Yeah,
you know, that was terrible. You're a waste of space.
Exactly. Okay. It's about, listen, I need more from you there. You know, you didn't give me this call on the inside to say go push, for example, in defence, or you're on the ground too long there. Fix that.
And that has more of an impact when it comes from a fellow player.
Massively, yeah. So, but as coaches, we gotta create that environment where that's acceptable, and there will be some conflict in the room because players are proud and they might argue back. It's about how you facilitate that. It's about how you foster, I suppose, that challenging environment. So I think for us, if we get that right this year, where we actually have an environment where players hold the coaches up to be accountable for our standards, for our detail, and then where the players and us as coaches make sure that we drive those standards, that's enough for us, I think.
Okay.
Putting posters on the wall, we're not ready for that yet. Like we're basically putting the foundations in place. Now
it's interesting you say you're not ready for that.
Is
that
we're going through a process with an outside company, a company of ex-Marines who've worked in sport and business, who are helping us define our values in a clear way. But I want us to be living them really before we start posting them on walls. So we know what they are, but before we're really outwardly talking about them, I want us to make sure that they're pretty much inbuilt.
Okay, that's interesting. So putting them up on the wall on the first day, winning is about what you do every day. You've got 1,000.
I don't think we're ready for that yet, to be honest. I don't think that's going to motivate us anymore. We need to establish an identity. Okay, so understand what playing for the Dragons means now, who we represent. So our purpose is to unite and inspire people in the region to be proud Dragons.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's our purpose. So then everything you do from there is relying back to that. So there was an intercept against us on Friday night, and Tyler Morgan covers 80 metres to make a try-saving tackle. You know, that's something that will inspire people to be proud Dragons. But you find examples of people not doing the right thing. Well, then you challenge that, you know. And I think that's just what we need to become good at, understanding, okay, we represent 73 senior clubs in the region, we represent all the schools, etc. Well, let's invite them to training sessions, let's create a a link with them.
Pat Lamb did that very effectively.
Yeah, he's very good at it. And I think that's really important. It's really powerful. The majority of our players have come from those small clubs. Well, let's make sure that those people are proud to come watch them on a Saturday. So, the Dragons had all that stuff on the wall when I came in, but we weren't living any of it. So
you got it taken down.
It's taken down, yeah.
Right. But,
and in fairness, they all agreed we weren't living it. And the CEO, he was saying, "Oh, but why are we doing this? We did that 3 years ago." And I said, "Yeah, but we didn't actually live any of it. We didn't put those things in place, you know. And we're hypocrites to put it up and actually not be hard on ourselves to do that."
That's really interesting. So we can all make New Year's resolutions.
Yeah.
Let's live it before we're ready to put it up on the walls. Yeah, when it's up on the walls, that's a sign that it's real for them.
Yeah. So what we do is if we win a game, we put a photograph from that game up on the wall.
Right.
So I think we've only done two so far because it's obviously a new season. We've only
They're
two
big photographs.
Yeah, big photographs. Yeah. But like, that's a statement for us of progress.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So we pick whoever's in the picture, puts it up in front of everybody, and hopefully over the course of this year we'll fill some of that wall. But it's not just about how much more we fill next year and the year after. I think it's so hard to find a project as raw as this one.
This is amazing.
Yeah, that's why it's really interesting.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, I'm sure a lot of people said, "Oh, why would you go to Dragons?" Because what they see on the pitch. But you have to understand where they're coming from and the opportunity to change.
Yeah, really interesting. Where did you learn all that stuff?
Is it
your own theories or is there someone?
I read a lot of books. You know what I mean? But I think...
Give me some books I should read.
From good to great. I think I read a lot of sports autobiographies. I love this stuff, but to be honest, it's core principles. It's happening in GA clubs, soccer clubs around the country. I think you can overdo the science part of it, and overdo the, like, so we have consultants, but I like the fact they've come from a marine environment where they've been there, done that. They have their processes, they have their systems, you know what I mean, and also they're able to adapt. So what happens, you know, when you land and a helicopter gets shut down, you know what I mean? What you grieve later, you gotta kick on. And I think it's just having common sense approach to us will get us a long way. Year one, I think once we establish that culture, we're gonna have to try and find different ways of getting that extra 2 or 3%, but just 25-30%
to be got
for us easily. And let's concentrate on those, you know.
Listen, thanks a million for coming in, because I appreciate, you know, time at home is probably very valuable.
Yeah,
so
I'm on the way to the airport. So
I'm sure you are. Okay. Well, Bernard Jackman, Dragons coach, will obviously be watching out for you over the course of the season. Lots of texts coming in saying best of luck and keep up the good work. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
Right, we'll take a break.
Off the Ball on News Talk. In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.